This show is brought to you by Safety FM.
Okay, hello and welcome to another round of Safety FM with Jay Allen. I hope everything is good and grand inside of your neck of the woods as we are hanging out on this lovely Tuesday, May the 27th. But don't worry, we're going to do a throwback here in just a brief moment of time. So don't go too far away because we're going to talk about a couple of things that are going on inside of the world of the multiverse here. So listen, a few weeks ago, I was at Energy Safety Canada and I got to hang out and take a listen to a whole bunch of presentations that were taking place. And I got the privilege of interviewing some of the presenters directly after their presentation. And that's where we're going to go here. This is a conversation that I got to have with Jody Goodall. If you're not familiar with her, Jody is the head of organizational reliability at Brady Haywood. She works with boards and senior leaders in high hazard industries to help them achieve reliable, predictable, and organizational performance. So if you are ready for this, we're going to talk a little bit about her keynote presentation at the end of her keynote, but we're going to play the presentation right away. Her presentation was titled Safety Performance Metrics, a Blindfold for Fatality Prevention, ? So keep that in mind. We're going to go ahead and go into that presentation right now and make sure that you stick around towards the end where you can hear our interview at the end, right after the end of the segment. So sit back, relax, and take a listen to what we have today on Safety FM with Jay Allen.
In safety, in my opinion, you woke up. You saw the system, the simulation, the structure that trained you to mistake compliance for care. Safety mutation. Information misdirection picks up where the signal fractured. Because the system didn't shut you down, it rebranded you. It packaged your voice, sold your rebellion as a new initiative, and smiled while doing it. This isn't a manual. It's a decoded transmission about what happens when slogans replace stories, when safety becomes marketing, and when truth gets mirrored so perfectly, you forget it was ever yours. You'll see the mutation. Learning teams turned into theater. Zero harm turned into optics. And feedback turned into formatting. But the signal didn't die. It was redirected. Safety Mutation is book two of the Signal Transmission Trilogy. Available now in print, Kindle, and audiobook. Narrated by the author, Jay Allen, PhD. Because the system adapted. Now it's your move.
Good morning, everybody. Businesses run on numbers. We collect a lot of data, and we turn some of it into performance metrics, and some of it we put targets against. And whether we like it or not, it drives our focus. It helps leaders to make decisions and anticipate failure. And it influences our culture. So you want to know that the metrics that you're relying on are telling you about the things that really matter, especially in safety. So today we're going to explore if our current performance metrics might be creating a blindfold, perhaps, to managing fatalities. So generally, when I ask leaders or safety professionals about their safety performance, we almost always get into a conversation about recordable injury rates. The TRIF, the RIF, LTIs, TRILF even. So just so we're all on the same page, if you took all of your injuries and you broke them up into buckets, classifications, you'd end up with something like this. And this is pretty much what you would see almost across the world. And, you know, lost time injuries is really common. And this is where people are injured enough that they need to take more than a day off work. But the other one you see is the TRIF, and this is where you've got lost time injuries or a person was injured, they couldn't come back to work for more than one day, or they were restricted, or they had medical treatment beyond first aid. So I just want you to raise up your hand if one of your like key company metrics or your main metric of how you look at in safety is one of these in your business. There's a fair few hands up. Yep. And that's really common. It's been around since the 1970s, this metric or these metrics, and they're our primary measure of safety. And in Australia, they're even built into our mining legislation, although we're starting to almost ignore that fact. We love them. And we put little equations in place and we standardise them by our worker exposure hours. And this allows us to use it to benchmark ourselves against others, to benchmark our sites against each other, to benchmark our contractors. And we link it to performance bonuses. We do barbecues. We reward in heaps of different ways. And you can see it in annual reports, ESG. And the reason I'm going through this is I want to really unpack how much it's infiltrated everything we do in safety. And we do it not because we think it's the wrong thing. We actually believe it's helping us to manage our risk. And it must, right? When our injury rate's going down, surely we're getting safer. That makes sense, rationally. Let's go deep into the Gulf of Mexico. It's April 2010. A helicopter with four senior executives is on board. They're heading out to one of their oil drilling rigs, and the execs have got a lot of deep sea drilling experience between them. This is a routine visit, a 24-hour management visibility tour. According to their company, this rig they're about to visit, it's got an impeccable safety record, one of the best in the country. So they're expecting the next 24 hours to be really pleasant. Later tonight, they'll be handing out awards for leaders for injury performance at a dinner on the rig. These drill rigs do really high-risk work. From the top of that rig to the seafloor is 5 kilometres, and the deeper the well, the more oil pressure, the higher the process failure risk. The chopper lands and the VIPs step out and start their tour. Today, the crew of the drill rig are at the point of sealing this well off, known as capping, and they're getting ready to move that whole rig to a new location. As part of that process, they're performing integrity tests, basically to make sure that the well's not leaking and that it'll stay tight after they disconnect. The tests are not looking good, like the well actually is leaking. And if this is the case, hydrocarbons and methane gas will be coming back up the pipe. As the crew repeat the tests, they're getting more and more concerned. Then the execs come through as part of their tour. They can see that the well integrity tests are troubling the team, but today they've got their own agenda. They're discussing hand injury awareness, dropped objects, and they're checking that the non-slip mats, which was an LTI improvement on another rig, is being implemented across this rig too. Our execs think they're leading safety here. They're not bad people. Like a lot of people, they have the belief that if they're managing the small injuries, they're going to prevent the big ones. To them, a lower injury rate means a safer rig. And this is reaffirmed to them because of the company effort that goes into it. Hell, their big bonus is attached to it. But within hours, from all over the rig, there's an unbearable hissing sound. Mud and seawater begin to blow everywhere onto the deck. The air smells and tastes like hydrocarbons. And then the gases coming up through the well find an ignition source on the rig. An explosion. The pressure wave reaches all over, and the PA system's bleeding fire, fire, fire. An engineer deploys the well blowout preventer. And this is a critical control, one that physically cuts the rig off from the well below and seals it, but it fails to operate. There's a backup system, and it fails too. 11 workers die, and 17 are seriously injured by this explosion, and the rig burns for 2 days, eventually sinking. 5 million barrels of oil spill into the sea for another 87 days, triggering the largest oil spill in history. You all know this story. It's the story of Deepwater Horizon, Macondo oil fields. But this little bit I've told you about is the same story. It's the same pattern you see in many other major accidents and fatalities. Companies that have a heavy focus on recordable injury performance and believe that if they manage their minor injuries, they'll prevent the big stuff, this is the same story. It seems so intuitively right. If your injuries are going down, you're getting safer. And it's a long-held belief. Right back to 1931, when Herbert Heinrich, an insurance guy, completed an analysis of his injuries. The breakdown of injuries was one major or serious, 29 minor to 300 no injury accidents. And traditionally, this has been interpreted by us as safety professionals as minor injuries are predictive of deaths and serious injuries, and the basis for a long time in how we've built our safety strategies. But is there even a relationship between recordable injuries and fatalities? Let's explore this. So in 2020, the Construction Safety Research Alliance, which is the top construction companies in the US and Boulder, Colorado University, did a really great report. And I suggest if you haven't read it, I'm sure you all know Matt Halliwell. It's fantastic. They asked the question, given the extent to which we use our injury metrics, how statistically valid are they? And it's a great study because it's based in data and it takes this super large data set and answers this really subjective question. It uses 17 years of injury and fatality data and 3.2 trillion work hours. And there's four key findings in the paper, but I'm just going to talk about the first one. Statistically, they found that there is no discernible association between the TRIF and fatalities. That is, trends in the TRIF don't associate statistically with fatality occurrences. Instead, fatalities seem to follow a different pattern, suggesting that they occur for different reasons. But that's construction at a massive industry level. Let's do a representation of some global companies in mining. I wonder if a company's own level of injuries correlates to its performance, fatality performance rate. This is a bunch of companies courtesy of the International Council of Mining and Metals and their 2023 benchmarking. And this is the TRIF that you can see here. So at the left-hand side is the worst TRIF performers, or the ones that had the highest TRIF. And on the other side, the lower side, is the best performers. And these have been standardised for a level playing field. Let's overlay their fatalities for the year. These red dots and the right-hand side of the graph is the fatality rate. So for each of these companies globally, we would expect that the injuries that were captured in the TRIF calculation were predictive or correlated, we'd be seeing the same pattern, best to worst, but they're all over the shop. The best TRIF performers are having fatalities too. The two worst TRIF performers were fatality free. And I show you this graph, I show you this for any other year, it's exactly the same pattern or not pattern. So we can start to see that a company's own injury rates don't even correlate to their fatalities. Let's go deeper and see why. Here's a study done in 2019 of seven global companies that you'll recognise across high hazard industries. They pulled their incident data and they had two really important findings. The first one is that the causes of serious injuries and fatalities is different to those of less serious injuries. The causes are different. And if the causes are different, we control them in different ways. The second one is really important too. It's that 80% of all of the things that make up the recordable injuries actually would never likely be any worse. So that means we're spending a lot of time on things that are never really going to be serious injuries and fatalities. Let's have a look at this in another way. Here's the mechanisms of how people get hurt in, this is mining in New South Wales, which is part of Australia and a big chunk of it. And what you can see here is that the top three ways that that makes up LTIs, and you'll all know this and it's similar in your industries, body stressing, so all the musculoskeletal type strains and sprains, slips and trips and falls on the same level, and being hit by moving objects. And this is usually made up, this particular data set is made up of hand injuries, mainly in tooling injuries. But if we look how people die in that same industry, it's very different. It's vehicle collisions, being involved in rollovers, heavy vehicles running over light vehicles. It's structural failures, it's electrocution. It's people being suffocated underground. Very, very different causes. Different mechanisms, different causes. But again, the key bit here is they're different controls. We manage them in different ways. And this makes sense when you think about a commercial airline. Imagine if they tried to convince us that we were safe to fly with them because they were telling us that their TRIF and their LTIs were really low. It would seem like madness, right? Why? Because the way we stop planes falling out of the sky is very, very different to how we stop baggage handlers getting muscle strains. So we have to see these things as separate. We've got to manage our fatality and our accident, our major accident risk, very independently of how we manage our TRIF and LTIs. One does not tell us about the other. And this is a mindset shift, and it's not something that will happen overnight, and it's something that each of you need to take back to your organisations and explain it in this much detail, because you're creating an emotional shift from what we truly believe now to where we need to get to. And leaders often say to me, yeah, Jodie, but at least when I'm thinking about the TRIF and I've got some programs in place, we're doing stuff towards safety. That's got to be good, right? Well, I've been in safety and risk a long time, in defence and explosives and the resources industry. And from early in my career, the TRIF was linked to my bonus. And I realised that as the safety manager, I actually had a lot of control over where the other people got their bonuses, because the TRIF is really managed within the safety department. And as a result, I got bloody good at managing it. And I got a confession to make. I know nearly every dirty trick in the book in how to reduce the TRIF and LTIs. One executive team even titled me the Queen of the TRIF. And it's something I'm not super proud of now, but at the time, yeah, they even gave me a little wand. Because if you get good at this stuff, it's not just about counting injuries. You got to run the best improvement campaigns that focus on your super high frequency events, your slips and trips, your hand injuries, ergonomics. You got to know how to find the loopholes and gain those injury classifications. Is it work-related? Does that person need prescription medication? Is there something else we can do? You've got to have injury management strategies that get workers back to work the next day. You've got to have really good early intervention programs. And I did all of this under the banner of being safer. And it was making a massive difference to our TRIF. And I told myself we were getting safer, that it was worth it. And then one of my sites had a fatality underground. Josh Martin died really slowly. He was crushed up against the roof of the mine. His last night shift, he fell asleep over the EWP controls, doing a long and boring task of uphold charging the explosives up into the roof. The dual control safety device that wasn't working correctly, and it kept pushing him up harder into the roof. The overhead protection that should have been in place and the emergency override both failed to operate. These were critical controls that the organisation assumed were in place and effective. Josh's workmates frantically tried to get him down as he suffocated, but they were too late. And it was this event that opened my eyes. Excuse me. It forced me to look at what I was doing as a safety professional. This focus on the TRIF, I realised, wasn't actually improving the organisation's capacity to prevent major accidents and fatalities. In fact, it was distracting our leaders from what really mattered. And what really matters is checking the fatal risk controls that are in, that making sure they're in place and effective all of the time. And I get it, it's really easy to be distracted by these things that are happening, these high frequency events that are happening right in front of you. But fatalities don't happen very often, and major accidents happen even more rarely. And this is even more reason to have metrics that are going to continually keep those front of mind and make sure you know the health of your controls. And it drives us to do other things when you've got these metrics that are strong in your business, like put signs on the front gate and include LTIs and the TRIF in performance bonuses with good intentions. We want to give the impression we care about safety. But it's got unintended consequences. Once you start to do this stuff, you create this pressure. Workers don't want to tell you what the real problems are. Rewarding injury performance creates this internal tension. It creates this tension called cognitive dissonance. And cognitive dissonance is a fancy name for a psychological process that occurs when a person holds really two contradictory beliefs in their head at the same time. You might be thinking, I've got an injury and I know I should report that, but could that be the one that breaks our site record? I don't want to be that person in my team. I'll just nurse it a little bit longer. Whoa, we have just had a massive close call. But I'm not sure if this is one of those incidents that is going to risk my bonus or maybe cause more paperwork for my supervisor. I'll just keep it to myself. And we know that, you know, some of the stats are that around only 20% of the big things that happen that can be hidden are reported. And so when people don't want to tell us stuff, whether they, you know, perceive it or otherwise, two things happen. We lose the opportunity to help a worker get early treatment, but also people do stop telling you things. It's really difficult to learn about the way your fatal risks are controlled. And when we're rewarding people, financially or otherwise, as I said, it kills the psychological safety to report. But you can put all the best systems in place, all the best HOP tools, all of those things, and still you're dealing with a cognitive dissonance. We have to take away the barriers as well as put the enablers in place. And do you think that we would still financially reward for things like the TRIF? Well, let me tell you what happens in Australia, and you can tell me about Canada. Here's a recent Australian example. In May 2020, the Anglo Grosvenor mine, which is that little red dot up in Queensland there, it's an underground coal mine in Queensland, and it was the site of a major methane explosion underground, and five workers almost lost their lives and were severely burned. The report says that workers had stopped talking to leaders about the conditions underground. Here's what their performance bonus looked like for all of those workers. It was a production bonus on the metres advanced in the mine. And it was up to $1,000 to $4,000 a month. But it had a safety modifier. So, and that was for the TRIF. So anything, if you had an LTI, a medically treated event, or a restricted work case, everyone on the site lost their bonus. So So you step into the shoes of a worker here. Would you want to talk? Or if you're a supervisor, would you want to encourage it? As leaders, we do create the cultures by what we measure, focus on, and reward. And this is a famous saying by Edgar Schein, who is the grandfather of culture, and this is what he's boiled it down to. So we need to choose really wisely our suite of metrics because they will influence our culture. Let's go back to our execs on Deepwater Horizon. They were 7 years LTI free when they had that major accident, and it didn't help them in the slightest. The company focus on injuries took their eye off the major hazards and the fatality risks. And the controls to manage these big risks weren't in place and effective. Think about the metrics that you're using in your business with your teams. Are they helping you to understand and prevent fatalities and serious injuries? Are they helping support your contractors to focus on fatalities? What about your industry? What do your industry groups do? What does your regulator do? How do they measure your safety performance? We can't continue to label recordable injuries as true safety performance. So what should we measure? Well, this question's a little more complex. Business is based on numbers. And I do not believe that taking safety metrics on the off the boardroom table, while there are still other metrics in finance and production, we actually need to have it still on the table to get it an equal say. But there are a few things to consider that to get the focus on from a leadership right from the top on fatality risk. The answer might lie in how the business actually does think about its financial health. We've got lots of metrics to understand our financial health, and they all come together to tell us a story. Some are leading, some are lagging. Some tell us how poorly we did, some tell us how well we did. Some measure the inputs, the important inputs, and some measure the health of our processes. Others measure our capacity to sustain our ability to do what we're doing now in the future. But imagine if we took away all of the metrics for an exec team and said they could have only one. What about cash flow? That's important, but it's certainly only part of the picture. In company law, you'd actually be seen as negligent if you tried to just measure your business on this one metric. And because it only really gives you part of the picture. And this is how we have to think about our safety metrics. We need a suite of metrics that tell us a story about how well we can sustain into the future. What's our capacity to manage safety? But also how well we're doing now. I totally get that. So you guessed it, just like finance, there's no silver bullet. It's a suite of metrics that will help us understand our fatality risk. The key thing is that they need to tell us about how well we're managing our fatal risk controls. And it depends where your business is at. The reason I'm not putting up a series of metrics here, which we do for some companies, is because you're all at different stages and different levels of maturity need different metrics. So either way, whether you're just starting out in managing your fatality risks, you might be setting your metrics around your program, or you might be able to measure your control health and the number of times you're checking those controls and who's checking them. But you also need your metrics to be able to anticipate the warning signs of failure. And remember, when you've got different causes, you need to be able to anticipate every single one of those types of causes, so all of your risks. And yes, you need to measure serious harm caused. You've got CIFA, and that's probably a good start for you. And then I suppose what we need to do is be able to tell these as a story, not see them as green and red. and really tell the be able to put that story forward for each of those risks up to our leadership teams. And so, in summary, you can't use recordable injuries as a proxy to understand whether you're managing your fatality risk. When we're rewarding the LTI and the TRIF, it's just driving underreporting, driving us to know less, learn less, and it diverts our leadership focus into other areas. And thirdly, we need to set these fatality metrics to tell us a story rather than green, amber, red about the health of each of our controls that are super important. Are they in place and effective? Thank you very much.
You just have to go to Slido and enter your questions. We've already got a couple up here, I see. If we could have that back, or I can try to find it on my phone again. Here we go. Here's the first one. How do we lead the change away from TRIF or T-R-I-R? How do you say that?
TRIF.
TRIF? What's the first one? T-R-I-R? We've touted it as a metric for so long that it's become what, for the most part, the C-suite and board knows and understands.
Yeah, just always say TRIF, Stacey. It's okay.
Always say TRIF. Okay.
Yeah, there's so many different ways of saying it, yeah. How do we lead the change away? Well, the first thing is kind of what I'm doing now, is we have to really break that emotional connection with it. And to do that, you've got to use, you've got to actually give the facts. Senior leaders really need to understand that it's, you know, this is not just about reporting and getting more reporting. It's actually about how, underlying the causes are super different between the TRIF and what causes fatalities. So until that, you know, they have that really clear mindset shift, it's going to be very, very difficult for you to infiltrate this at an industry level.
All right, another question. Given that so many companies tie bonuses to safety statistics, what's the alternative? Should we remove the monetary incentive? Is there another way that you can tie safety to a bonus or to an incentive at least?
Absolutely. So, you know, you should reward the behaviours you want to see. There are a lot of proactive metrics, and these are around control health. Once you clearly understand your fatality risks and you understand your critical controls, the controls that manage the most amount of those risks, and you've defined those, what businesses do is they go out and they check those controls and they make sure they're in place and effective, and they learn when they're not. And so that is the behaviours that at all levels of the business you want to be monetary incentivising. So at the most senior leader level, you're actually incentivising the development and the health of those programs to go out and understand the critical controls and check them. And at the front line, you're making sure those controls are in place and effective and the programs to manage that. And in the middle management, that we are actually resourcing and driving critical control health programs.
Okay. How do you now recommend companies reward good safety performance corporately? Kind of just answered
same
that.
Thing, yeah.
From a board perspective, without metrics, how can they judge how good a job management is doing on safety?
I think you should absolutely have metrics around this, absolutely. Maybe don't put targets on everything, but really use your metrics more than a red, amber, green, and start to talk about them to get leaders fascinated about their control health. And actually what happens is when you start to really define your fatal risks and your most important controls, and then you start to check them, you find that they're not in place half as often as you thought. And you get this, alarming, people start to get alarmed. But if that's teamed with an approach from the senior leaders that they really want to hear that information, then people start to get fascinated about their control failures, and it just changes the whole focus in a business from trying to prevent, you know, all the high frequency events to really making sure that their fatality risk management system is as effective as it really can be.
All right, this has been a 2-decade discussion. Love that you address this. What are some good resources for expanding the focus of metrics?
Some good resources. Look, a lot of people are putting together indices and stuff like that. I think you should be really conscious that you need to think about where your organization is at and the maturity of your organization before you blindly go and pick 10 metrics that someone's written in a paper. But I do think that one of the biggest things you can do is really work on your SIFPs. So that is information that's coming into you now. I've looked at your SIFP data from an industry perspective, and you're not reporting half as much as you should be. And, you know, it's the same thing that's happening in oil and gas in Australia. So absolutely start to think about how you can learn better from those. In terms of other resources, I mean, Matt Halliwell's work that I quoted is a really good one. And I suppose the ICMM, the International Council of Mining and Metals. Until you've really, I know I'll keep harping on this, clearly defined all of your fatal risks and your most important controls down to understanding the performance of each of those, it's going to be really hard for you to get a laser focus. So the ICMM has a good practice guide and an implementation guide that are really, really helpful to be able to step your organisation through that process.
All right, lots of great questions coming in. Are you working with industry leaders and organizations like ISnet to change how safety is measured and talked about?
Yeah, we do work with a lot of industry bodies and regulators because, you know, the regulator inherently does drive the culture from a different angle, and bodies like Energy Safe Canada, absolutely, it depends on the country, on who are the most influential, but absolutely industry bodies are reaching out and we are, you know, having those conversations with them too.
How do we convince regulators to change their metric reporting system? It's difficult for industry when we're regulated by stats.
Yeah. I hope there's some regulators in the room. And hey, I'm offering the presentation to you.
So that's how we convince them, like give me your presentation and hopefully they are in the room. Can Energy Safety Canada lead the charge? We need to move together.
Yeah, I think they're already starting to. Certainly the conversations we're hearing within Energy Safety Canada is exactly that, is the real need to move. And I think there just needs to be, you know, higher level discussions with the most senior leaders within, you know, the top companies and the top, you know, second tier contractors to really drive this from that approach. I mean, in Australia, what we're still seeing is that, like, we have this training called the Australian Institute of Company Directors, which is how every board member is trained, and still those guys are using LTIs and TRIF to train boards on what they should be focusing on for safety. So I think you've got to just hit this in a lot of different ways to really make it hit home. And I know we've been going at it for 20 years, but can you believe we're still talking about it? It seems crazy.
Part of the reason boards love TRIF is because they can compare to other companies, just because they're numbers, right? So it's easy to compare. What is a replacement metric that measures what matters?
Yeah, if you want one lagging metric, as long as you promise me you're not going to rely on this, but, you know, I think if we were going to make any shift, even in a small increment, it would be to move from TRIF to CIFAs. And that's still internationally recognised. And, you know, what we're seeing in parts of Australia now, as I said, it was in mining legislation for a long time, or resources legislation, the TRIF was, and that's how, you know, the regulators measured as well. But what we're seeing in Australia is that Treasury now, in the government, measures the regulators using CIFA. Or very similar.
Is there reluctance in that?
There's not from the regulator over there. Once they've had that mindset shift that actually they were focusing on all the wrong stuff and then wondering why, you know, their inspectors weren't focusing on fatality risks and were still going out there hazard hunting, you know, the I suppose, their senior leaders. They're, you know, now that they're measured on something that really is on serious injuries and fatalities, their whole programs are shifting as well.
Okay. Can you provide some concrete examples of metrics around critical controls outside of just counting inspections?
Yep, good. So that's a really good question, whoever wrote that. Absolutely. You need to measure the activity, so the counting, but you have to supplement that with understanding control effectiveness. And so once again, once you've defined your critical controls for each of your fatality risks, and you've got a clear set of performance, objective performance criteria, it's really easy to go out there and start to put reds and greens, red, amber, greens, against whether your controls are in place and effective, down to a performance level. And so we've got time. I'm just going to give an example, if that's
100%.
All right.
Yeah, that's, yeah, what they, that's what they want. Yeah.
Fantastic. So if you're thinking about fall from height risk, I'll just give you one that is kind of easy for us all to think about. A critical control might be the fall prevention devices that we use as a last line of defence. Yep, it's PPE, but absolutely it's still a critical control because it manages a fair whack of the risk. So you need to go further than just going and checking whether fall prevention, fall arrest devices are in place in the field. We have to have a clear objective set of criteria around what's important, and that has to be written in ways that aren't subjective. So the first thing is you write criteria that might be there's a storage area that, and you would have requirements around the storage area, that people who are using fall prevention devices are trained to a certain standard, and that's a certain with a certain frequency associated with it, that the equipment is bought to a standard. In Australia, we have an Australian standard for that, that it's that the people know how to inspect it, and it's inspected every time beforehand, and that there's maybe an out of service process. They might be your five performance criteria, and they're written in ways that don't use words like appropriate, suitable, relevant, all of those things that lead us into subjectiveness. Now you've got a crunchy criteria, you can start to put metrics around. Once you've got that, you can start to go and not only count the number of times that you go and check it, but you can actually start to put metrics around the effectiveness of it as well. And that kind of stuff, you can start to roll up really crunchy into whether your controls are in place and effective, and you can use it to create patterns of warning signs of failure, and then you can give that to your senior leaders and they can start to understand how well their risk is actually being managed.
All right. Agree the focus should be on serious injury reduction, but we also don't want people to get hurt, even minor injuries. How do we focus on both?
So I'm definitely not suggesting that you stop managing the things that are slips and trips and the things that do create high frequency that hurt people. What I'm suggesting is that it shouldn't be your company metric. You shouldn't have that kind of false sense of security that it is and talk about it, because still senior leaders talk about this as if when their TRIF is going down that they're preventing fatalities. I'm just saying that it's not a metric we should be using as a target. People don't go to work to hurt themselves. And, you know, so what are you actually measuring when you're doing that? You really, you know, you're not measuring anything that is going to drive your business to improve. You're just measuring, unfortunately, events that happen all the time. Still put your processes in place, still care about your people, absolutely.
All right, how can you help your company transition away from the primary focus on TRIF when the client slash owner group uses TRIF as a pre-qualification tool for companies?
Yeah, it's tough, isn't it? Bloody tough being a contractor. Absolutely. So I think, you know, don't feel bad about asking to, you know, take this kind of content and really put the crunchy facts around that to your own senior leaders, and certainly to your, you know, and going with ways that you can manage your, you know, you explain your health and safety performance to your principal, you know, miners or resource people.
So how do you do that? Knock, knock, knock on the door. What do you do? That's the next question, is how do you approach leaders who are adamantly pro-TRIF?
Yeah. tough, isn't it? Keep doing it. Keep doing it. Really get your message clear. And, you know, I think what where I hear a lot of safety professionals get to on this is they start just defaulting back to reporting. And, you know, in a leader's mind, remember that they're in these senior leader roles. They've probably been, you know, 20, 30 years in a leadership role, and the TRIF has gotten them that far. So you are breaking some really long-held beliefs. So you've got to go with facts. Go with your own data. Go with your industry's data. Encourage Energy Safety Canada to put together the stats and a white paper that really leads this, and use that information. Use the Construction Safety Research Alliance statistical analysis. Just don't get caught up in all the you know stats. Keep to the findings and the facts. Make sure your message is crystal clear. And white papers are a really good way to do this internally within a company, because it's written on paper. People can take that away and absorb the information. So it's really just an information paper, and you could use the basis for my presentation as that.
What is your perspective on organizations using an incident-free day metric as another way to look at incident reporting?
Do you really want an incident-free day? So it depends what you define an incident as. I mean, I would say, every single group I speak to, I say you're not reporting enough CIFPs, which means you're not learning about your serious injuries and fatalities. You know, what good looks like is probably four times what you're doing now. But to do that, you are going to have to put different learning processes in place that probably don't mean that every CIFP's got 2 weeks' worth of investigation associated with it. So an incident-free day metric is probably a day when you just didn't learn. Mm.
You heard a little bit of a reaction there in the crowd.
Yeah. I don't know. I don't know whether that was a sigh of relief or...
What alternative metrics should companies report externally, as TRIF is reported as part of performance scorecards?
I think if your organisation really doesn't want to move away from the TRIF right now, it can supplement that straight up with a CIFA. Is a really good way to start. I think that's a really, really good way to start. And that's probably part one. And part two is just start to not put any rewards or even talk about the TRIF with people below board level. There's just no need for it. It's not actually helping you do anything.
So we're going into our boss's office. Is your presentation available to the audience?
Absolutely. Yeah, for sure. No worries. Yep.
Do you think the stuff that can kill you is a tool in the right direction?
Yes. There are heaps of really good tools like this. Sticky, HECA, you know, a lot of the HOP tools. Absolutely. All I would encourage you, the good thing about Sticky is it really does encourage that focus towards fatal risks and critical controls. Take some of your HOP tools or the things that you're using now to start conversations, and absolutely use fatal risks and critical controls as the theme that you're putting this under. So if you're using your HOP tools to just continually understand slips and trips and stuff like that, I think that you can be doing, you know, spending your time more valuably. Yeah.
In terms of hierarchy of controls, how do we convince leaders to focus on implementing most effective controls versus the least effective, which include PPE and admin?
So if I could draw right now, I don't have a whiteboard in front of me, but we did this yesterday in the fatal risk workshop. Does everybody in the room know what a hierarchy of control looks like? Yeah, so you got this kind of big triangle. At the top, you've got elimination, substitution, isolation. And if I drew a line underneath isolation and I had below admin controls and PPE, there's one fundamental difference between the ones at the top and the ones at the bottom. And does anyone know what that is? Come on, someone from the risk workshop yesterday.
Hard and soft
controls, thank you very much. So the ones up the top are hard controls. And the reason we can group all those together as hard is they're actually doing something to treat the hazard. Whereas the ones underneath that line, the soft controls, fundamentally all they're really doing is teaching or telling a person how to manage that, how to actually work around that, to be more careful. So if you're engineering, or putting isolation devices in place, you're actually really doing something to manage or treat the hazard. Everything else, all your procedures, signage, training, all of those things are just teaching workers how to be more careful.
How can we influence frontline workers to focus on fatal hazards and controls when completing hazard assessments versus generic trip, fall, slip, and housekeeping?
Yep. So remember, these things don't happen very often. So the first thing you've got to do in your business is to get this kind of risk imagination that things actually can go wrong. And the best way to do that is to start two things. The first one is to be really clear as a business what your fatal risk, critical controls, what they look like when they're in place and effective, and not just make that one training package and then, you know, put it in the drawer. Make sure that information is available when workers are doing their JHAs, you know, have posters up that actually show what the critical controls are and what they look like when they're in place and effective. But the other thing is creating this kind of risk imagination. And, as I said, think these bad things don't happen very often. Storytell. Teach people how to storytell and keep the stories alive of how people die in your industry and with the risks that people are trying to manage every day.
There are a lot of different ways that organizations define SIF. Is there a best definition for what a serious injury is?
Yeah, I think the one you guys use at the moment, something around hospitalisation. There are many different ways of doing that. I just think you, and we've, you know, been talking to Energy Safety Canada, a couple of people who were in the workshop yesterday. Haven't quite got this to Vanita and Amy yet. We shouldn't be saying this out loud. But it's worth doing a benchmarking to understand how other countries are looking and thinking about SIF as well, and seeing whether your approach at the moment is the right definition. So I don't want to say whether it is or not, but I definitely think it's worth looking broader and then bringing that back if you want to be a best practice.
All right, a few more questions. We have time for a couple more. What do you think the biggest barrier is creating change with industry leaders, and how can we be still having this discussion?
Yeah, I do think it is that the senior leaders, this has got them this far. And so, you know, really they feel successful and they feel like they know how to manage the TRIF and they know all of the levers that they need to pull. You've got to create that same comfort with how we manage fatalities, and that, I'm telling you, I've seen it in programs and the shift, within companies, is this concept of having a critical control management program is exactly what it is. It becomes real and crunchy, and they can see how it works. They can see how they can manage their fatality risks, and they've got a new focus.
Is there an international standard for categorizing SIFP events? Our organization debates which events have potential for permanent injury, fatality, or et cetera.
I don't think there is an international standard. And sometimes the international standards are that old and outdated. You're best off doing your own, you know, broad scan.
Yeah. What are your thoughts on mitigated SIF events vis-a-vis critical controls have functioned as designed as a performance measure?
So this is like looking at zero barrier events to where a control worked. Absolutely. So, you know, what we know as really good practice is to dig into what worked and what didn't. And I'm always really conscious of this concept of downplaying a SIF event because one control worked. And I'll give you an example. We've got a couple of minutes.
Yeah, of course. Yeah, go ahead, yeah. Please.
So when if a crane's bringing a load in and it's carrying a pipe and the pipe slips out of the way they've rigged it, bounces, lands inside the exclusion zone, a lot of people will say, oh, that's not a SIFP. The exclusion zone worked, and you can argue that till you're blue in the face both ways. But you just got to think about why you really want SIFPs reported. And it's not to tick a box and to count and to be able to analyse that later. It's actually to understand where your controls weren't in place and effective and what's making them in place and effective. And so there's a couple of things going on that you can learn from that particular event. You could dig into whether, you know, there's an opportunity for that load to have fallen out. And I give you this event because I actually went through this with a power station, and the crane driver was the only guy who had the expertise to say, yeah, that was a pipe. It bounced and we're just really lucky that it landed in the drop zone. You know, 9 times out of 10, it probably would have gone across that walkway and out into the, you know, out across into people. So even though sometimes we think our controls are working, we can still learn about their weaknesses by listening to our experts. And that's what SIFPs do, is they should give those situations a voice and experts to really help you understand how to make your controls more robust. Have I said enough times, understand your fatal risks and determine whether your critical controls are in place and effective? Because it really is the where this is where really it's at in terms of understanding fatal risk.
Thank you so much. That was fantastic. And some great questions from the audience today. Thank you very much for your presentation.
Thank you.
Okay. So you just came off the stage. We ran you across the building and here we are. So I have to ask, because there's a lot of references that you came up with during your presentation. So, and just for us to know what's going on, the listeners here are going to hear your presentation, and we're going into real time right afterwards. You talked a lot about SIFPs. I want to go to common listener. What if they don't know what that means? Can you give them a definition?
Yeah, sure. So it should be any event that happens on a site where there's a potential for a serious injury or a fatality.
Okay.
So it doesn't matter what actually happened. It's about could there have been in a different, given a certainly different, slightly different circumstance.
So in some areas, would you say near miss?
Yeah, absolutely. Okay. Yeah, a near miss that has a potential for a fatality or a serious injury.
I just want to get common lingo for just in case if some people don't know exactly what it is. You talked about HOP tools.
Yep.
And I want to understand what you mean by that, because I know that HOP for the most people is a philosophy, but you said HOP tools, so that stuck out. What do you mean when you say that?
Yeah, I mean the good thing about HOP is it really starts to bring some crunchy tools in that encourage us to understand normal work. And you know, I mean, you see things like the 4Ds, learning teams, that kind of stuff. It depends on who you work with to what types of tools you have. It also could be things like HECA as well, so it's not specifically just HOP, but they're all really tools that will help us understand it from a worker's perspective or what's happening at the front line. So we don't just have to rely on events, which is probably where we've been in the past. So these things are really good. And what I would love to see is that they really start to focus more on things that have serious injury and fatality potential. That's where I'd love to see us move.
Okay. And then you reference HECA. For the people that are not familiar with it, what are you referencing?
So HECA comes out of the Construction Safety Research Alliance and Boulder, Colorado, that connection. And they have been starting to look at the...
And Matt was here last year, but I don't know.
Yeah, so. Cool. Yeah, so really it's about understanding whether the physical controls that prevent fatalities and serious accidents are in place at the job site on the day. And so it really encourages the leader to have this structured approach to go out and talk about the big risks, talk about whether the most important controls are in place, and check whether they're effective. So you're having this kind of more valuable, rich conversation. Another tool, and the way it's, I suppose, the added benefit of that, or maybe another way of gaming the system, is that it gives you a metric at the end. So you end up with this kind of percentage of, controls that are in place. Really, really good. Again, if you think about how you manage fatality risk and process safety risk, the controls that you put in place on the front line on the day are super important, but they're only one piece of the puzzle. So we have to also think about whether the system is in place that leads work to be designed and delivered in a way that when the people turn up on the day, they've got everything they need. It's going to happen in a planned manner. It's the method is going to be as good as it possibly can be. So they're only managing the last small amount of risk. Yeah, so HECA's really good, but I think you still have to supplement that stuff with this kind of organisational approach and recognise that there are bigger things within the company and within the industry happening that you need to manage as well. So that taking that real systems approach, Jay.
So you referenced also at one point that you gamified the system in regards to what you were doing, being known as, did you say Triff Queen? Is that how you worded it? So can we get some of behind the scenes on what you were doing? I'm not trying to get you to give out the details for people to start doing it, but for them to have a kind of a level of understanding on how are you gamifying it? Because, you know, some people believe in the data. It's like, this is what the data said, so it can't be wrong. Yeah. Not realizing that there's filters that it goes through.
Oh, there's so many things that happen. I know I'm not the only person who have done this, but I suppose not a lot of people talk about it, is, you know, having really aggressive injury management strategies that get workers back to work the next day. You know, so I'll give you a couple of examples, and I'm not proud of this stuff. Right. This is stuff that, you know, I did 10 years ago in my career that really I look back on now and gives me shivers down my spine about just how shit it was, really. Mm-hmm. But, you know, things like if you starting off the site morning meeting by checking and naming who is on restricted duties, who's going to manage those people, what supervisor's in charge of them. So, you know, really, is that the best way to start a day? Is that the most important conversation that you need to be having? But that stuff puts a laser focus on restricted work and gets people back to work maybe before their 2 days and means they're not classed as a restricted injury, so they don't meet your TRIF. Other things are...
Interesting seeing your demeanor, and of course people can't see this, but your demeanor has entirely changed when you started talking about this.
I feel so guilty about it, but, mm-hmm. but I mean, even you can give Voltaren, which is an anti-inflammatory. There was a time there where you could give an extra non-prescription tablet and be, and a doctor could do that and be giving the same amount of medication as what they would normally give as a prescription anti-inflammatory, which is, you know, like a first line treatment that would help you manage, you know, the first day or so, which meant that it wasn't medically treated.
Right.
Why are we focusing on that stuff? Like, why is that even important? Why would I even try and influence a doctor, or, you know, whether that's a company doctor or not?
Well, you had a bonus program on there that you showed that between $1,000 to $4,000. Of course, that's what you would influence it.
Yeah. And actually, it was much more lucrative for the senior mm-hmm. leaders. But they're the types of things that when you put financial rewards around things that can be gamed, absolutely, people will game them.
So let me ask a kind of a strange question. If you were going to build out an organization, you're starting it from scratch, what would the layout look like? Like, how would you structure this in regards of, we can take a look at how the organization would be laid out, how you would tie yourself into safety. Are you basing it off of HRO? Are you basing it off of something else? Exactly what would the structure look like?
Do you mean from like a performance metric?
You can say performance metric. Let's say we're just starting a business from scratch.
Yeah.
How would you lay out the layout of the land? I know. That's why I ask.
Well, one of the key things I think is to anything that you do understand all of the different ways that it can be gamed, and so, you know, setting performance metrics. The metrics that you set for a business don't particularly need to be talked about often at below a site, you know, site level. So as you get closer to the people who do the work, the people who lead the work, those kind of things, the metrics need to be more positive performance based. So you're trying to encourage and drive a focus on the things you want to see, not the times that it goes wrong, because then you're really helping organisations to drive their behaviours in on the things that drive. That actually do drive performance. And so, you know, you would have heard me say, and you guys will hear me say if you're about to listen to my presentation, deeply understand your fatal risks, understand what controls manage a fair bit of that risk, and determine, continuously be fascinated by whether they're in place and effective and find heaps of different ways to do that. Your SIFs can tell you that. Your performance metrics can tell you that. Certainly every single piece of assurance, JHAs, like if you've got JHAs that are listing slips and trips and that kind of basic stuff, we know people manage that the best way they can. You really need to be going out there and checking whether they're, talking about their fatal risk and their critical controls. But that's from a metrics perspective. From a business design perspective, if you have a really laser focus on your fatality risks and your critical controls, that should be built into your strategy, into your procurement strategy, into the way, where you put your engineers in the business. It should be back into your org design. You're starting to make sure that people have got access to that information, that you're thinking about that in the way you're designing not only work, but the way you're planning, where you go next in your mind, what your strategy is long-term as a business. And certainly, you're really just designing your whole organisation right around your risks. And we want to move away from compliance. When I say move away, what I mean is use it as a base and recognise it's a pretty low base. And we need to overlay the risks, the activities of the business to really deeply understand how to manage this thing. And really, all of this is aimed at preventing deaths and serious injuries.
Well, I think that's what people tend to forget, is that this is the low entry to in regards of getting into the organization for the most part. So if you have a flag-carrying line-level worker that wants to get this into their organization, where would you point and direct them to get more information?
I think the first thing is to start with the ICMM, which is the International Council of Mining and Minerals. They have a good practice guide and an implementation guide, which really sets out how an organisation should go about deeply understanding their fatality risks, understanding their critical controls, and how to make them in place and effective. And you can team that with any of the tools that you're already using, whether you're using HECA or you're using HOP or whatever you've got. You can, once you've got that kind of North Star of your fatal risk critical controls, you can just overlay that as, are all of the parts of our management system, are we reporting those types of incidents? Are we checking, is our assurance and our audits checking that? So you're not replacing your system. What you're doing is just giving it a focus, a laser focus.
Now, if people want to find out more about the work that you're doing, where can they find out?
We've got a pretty good YouTube channel, and we've got a couple of podcasts. I love the Rethinking Safety podcast because it comes off the back of our Brady report, which was into mining fatalities in Queensland, but it's totally relevant for everybody outside of mining as well. You'll find that if you're in any kind of high hazard industry, all of those same things, you'll just keep saying, oh, that happens with us, that happens with us. So certainly start with our website and the Brady Report and our YouTube channel. And we're on LinkedIn, but also we've got a couple of podcasts as well. So the Rethinking Safety podcast is four really great episodes that are really aimed at middle management frontline, and they talk about how to implement some of this stuff at a really practical level. And they use a lot of people from the mining industry who are either struggling with it or have been doing really well with it.
Well, Jody, I appreciate you coming in.
Thanks, Jay.
The views and opinions expressed during this broadcast, podcast, or radio show are solely those of the host and guests and do not necessarily reflect the official policy or position of Safety FM and/or Radio Big. The content discussed, including examples of analysis, is provided for illustrative purposes only. It should not be applied as the sole solution in real-world scenarios, as it is based on limited and dated open source information. Any assumptions made during this broadcast, podcast, or radio show are not reflective of Safety FM and/or Radio Big. No portion of this broadcast, podcast, or radio show may be reproduced, stored in a retrieval system, or transmitted in any form or by any means, electronic, mechanical, recording, or otherwise, without prior written permission of Safety FM and/or Radio Big. For permission requests, please contact contact Safety FM or Radio Big directly.